From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, Georgia became the 14th state to ban the box, the Georgia state government removing the little box you've been asked to check on its job application asking if you've been convicted of a crime. It's a way, advocates say, for those with criminal records to get a second chance to get back into society. When 70 million Americans have some kind of criminal record, it's a big deal. But some employers are saying, wait, we have the right, the need to know. This hour, On Point, criminal records, employment, and the push to ban the box on job applications. You can join us on air or online with this conversation as always on, should employers ask job applicants right up front, first thing, if they're convicted criminals? How do we get all those people with criminal records back into the economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It's not just Georgia. 14 states doing this. New Jersey's change went into effect just this week on Monday. Here was Governor Chris Christie. This was last August on the steps of Trenton City Hall, signing that bill into law requiring employers to interview job applicants before asking them about their criminal record if they have one.
This is a state that believes that every life is precious and that no life is beyond salvation, that everyone deserves a second chance in New Jersey if they've made a mistake.
Right, left, and center, there's been a lot of support for this. Senator Rand Paul supporting it, Newt Gingrich getting behind it. Also, people just right across the political spectrum, but also pushback from people saying, wait a minute, we want to know. Joining me first today from Washington is Benjamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He's been writing about just how hard it can be for people with arrest or conviction records to get into the workforce. Benjamin Applebaum, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you describe the scale of this problem and where the weight of it really falls?
So this is a problem that is essentially created by modern technology. It used to be really difficult for employers to comprehensively check the background of a job applicant. Mm-hmm. You basically had to call the courthouse in any county you were interested in knowing about and ask them to look and see whether that person had a criminal record. But the availability of digital records has created an opportunity for employers to run fairly comprehensive checks on anyone they want to hire to see whether or not they have a criminal background. And employers have both seen that as a useful tool and at the same time are under a great deal of pressure to do it for reasons of liability and safety. And so this has become really very ubiquitous. About 9 in 10 employers in some surveys say that they do background checks on at least on applicants for at least some kinds of jobs at those companies. So really, you know, it's become very unusual for employers to not be doing background checks. It's really the status quo now. And at the same time, we've seen this huge growth in the number of Americans who have criminal records. There's this amazing new study by a professor at the University of Minnesota that finds that 10% of males, non-incarcerated males, have been convicted of a felony. The number with misdemeanor convictions is larger still. The number with arrest records is even bigger than that. You referenced that figure of 70 million. That is a lot of people who are confronting in some form this new world in which having a criminal record can be a disqualifying barrier to even getting in the door for a job interview.
Well, let's talk about that. How important has that been? Have employers just tossed applications? If you know, there's the little box, if it's still there, if it's not in one of the states where it's now banned. It says, do you have an arrest or conviction record? If you check that, are you out? Are you done right there? You report on some cases where that's the way it goes.
It varies tremendously. So that has always been that practice of just systematically excluding applicants is pretty legally problematic. And large employers are generally a little bit more careful about it than that. But there's a tremendous amount of anecdotal evidence that, yes, many employers are doing exactly that, that they are fairly systematically screening out applicants. And there's sort of two categories here. There are many jobs for which that's the law. There are many jobs in this country where state legislators or the federal government has essentially imposed a restriction on people with criminal records working in those jobs.
Like what, law enforcement or what would it be?
So there are the obvious ones, right? So obviously law enforcement jobs are people who are working with small children or other vulnerable populations like the disabled. But this has really been a case of mission creep in recent years. So port workers, longshoremen are now prohibited from working at the nation's ports if they've had a criminal conviction in the last 7 years. That used to be the type of job a person could get, even if they had a bit of a checkered history. But safety concerns since 9/11 have put it off limits. Many state licensing requirements, and licensing requirements are something that's really spread like a virus in recent years, now include specifications about criminal records as well. So a significant portion of available jobs are just off limits if you have a criminal record. Ones that are not often are screened out.
What's the impact of this that you found in your reporting on individual lives and on communities?
So the individual impact can be absolutely devastating, because what you're doing is making it very difficult for a person who has made a mistake, who has broken the law, and who has paid the price for doing that, to become a productive member of society again, to find a job that can allow them to provide for their family or their loved ones, or even to take care of themselves. And in some cases, it clearly pushes these men to, you know, return to lives of crime. There's a real problem of recidivism associated with the inability to find work. For the communities, the collective impact of all of those individual disruptions is devastating. And for our nation's economy as well, we have a real problem in this country where the share of men in particular who are participating in the workforce has been in steady decline in recent decades. And it appears that one reason for that is that a growing share of the population finds itself excluded from participating in the workforce. So that's a huge economic cost. And when the governor of Georgia signed that executive order that you referenced, what he said about it was basically, we need this for our economy. This is a competitive advantage for us to be restoring these people to the workforce, to be increasing the size of Georgia's workforce.
700,000 people released from prison every year in this country. They are or are not reintegrated into the economy and into ordinary life. Binya Applebaum's been writing about it for the New York Times, and there's a lot of attention being focused on this right now across the country. 14 states now, about 100 cities have said, let's ban that little box that says, check right here, right off the bat, if you've got an arrest or a criminal conviction in your background. Binya Applebaum, please stand by in Washington. With us right now from Philadelphia is William Cobb, convicted in 1994 of robbery, criminal conspiracy, and kidnapping. There was an abduction of a drug dealer's relative for ransom. He served 6.5 years in prison. He's since turned his life around and founded the organization Redeemed to fight against systematic employment discrimination against people who have been arrested or convicted of a crime. William Cobb, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
When people saw your conviction and you were looking for a job after that 6.5 years doing your time in prison, what was the reaction, William?
Tom, over the last 15 years, I've found it extremely difficult to acquire and maintain suitable employment. Obviously, I have had some opportunities where I've done extremely well in the workforce, but when those opportunities dried up, I've been facing the same history for the last 15 years. So on many occasions, I've had the ability to get past the interview stage and actually become a part of an organization, only to be terminated after they discovered that my criminal record was in existence, although in many cases, I conveyed as much to the potential employer.
How do you think that they're looking at this? Are they looking at you and saying, oh my gosh, once upon a time, he was convicted of robbery and kidnapping and crime. He may do it again, or it's in his record. We just don't want to be hassled out.
I think the latter is more so what's happening. Discrimination against our population is so pervasive that it's embedded in the policies of human resource officials. Anybody who is responsible for hiring a candidate ultimately has to sign off and take responsibility for bringing that person aboard of an organization.
Yeah.
However, during the interview, in many cases, I'm offered the job. I convey to them that I've been convicted, and they say, listen, this is okay. Your resume matches exactly what we need. We know that you're going to be a tremendous asset to the organization. And there have been many times when people in the organization have gone to bat for me, but their policies were so antiquated that nobody could overcome them. And as a result, on more than over a dozen occasions in the last 15 years, I've been terminated and then hired and then terminated.
Bill, what's the impact of this bill on communities where you've got a lot of people who have a record of one kind or another, criminal record?
Well, as a result, communities are unsafe, families are torn apart, and people are cast into inescapable deep poverty. Many of the people that I served time with, Because of the work that I've done in the city of Philadelphia and continue to do, mm-hmm. I'm in touch with them on a daily basis. So lots of people are unwilling to engage in criminal activity anymore, and now we're just subject to living in inescapable deep poverty. They're dependent upon the community taxes in order to be able to provide for themselves. So wherever you go and you find pockets of deep poverties and communities in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and throughout the nation, you'll find a direct correlation with people who are living with arrest and conviction records.
And how big a problem for those communities can this be, Bill?
The problem is so large that many of our leaders are failing to address the issue. It impacts public safety. It impacts local economies by the fact that people do not have the ability to make, you know, take care of themselves, provide for their children, and then those children end up automatically living in poverty. So it's an inescapable cycle that costs, that's actually costing America right now. Because as piggybacking on what Mr. Applebaum said, estimates are that 70 to 100 million Americans have had touches with the criminal justice system, and as a result, are being kept out of the workforce in one way, shape, or form or the other.
You must have many times wished you could go back and not have been involved in that robbery, kidnapping, but that's there. Do you think that the country is changing, that we're going to turn this around so people who've done their time, served their time, and rehabbed will have better access to the job market? Do you see that coming?
I do see it coming. What's happening is that because America's tough-on-crime policies have failed, conversations have been around as to what this country can do in order to put itself back in the position of being one of the most powerful nations in the world. So we realize that by eliminating one-third of potential workforce, companies and organizations are losing out on talented people, and it's impacting their bottom line. And also, there are organizations in the country, such as Just Leadership USA, which I'm a part of, that are facilitating conversations to have people who are closest to the problem to begin implementing solutions.
William Cobb, we got to cut it right there. We're so grateful to you for coming on. William Cobb in Philadelphia with Redeemed. Good luck to you, Bill.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about finding a job after a criminal conviction. 70 million, maybe, Americans face that challenge. There's a new push on to make it not so hard. A lot of states are now saying ban that box, that little checkbox on the front of the job application that could derail effectively the search for a job right there, has for many people. Benjamin Applebaum has written about it in depth for the New York Times. Washington correspondent there joins us today from Washington. Here's Mark O'Brien, convicted of negligent homicide, went to jail in Maryland, now works for an organization helping ex-convicts find housing and jobs after prison.
Do we want to live in a country where people have second chances? Do we want to live in a country where we believe in redemption and that people can improve their lives? Or do we want to live in a country where a single mistake or several mistakes, youthful mistakes sometimes, follow a person for the rest of their lives?
It's not easy. Washington, D.C. resident Sharif Phelps Eel says she's had difficulty finding work after going to jail twice for felony assault, fighting with other women. She wants to get her life back on track, doesn't hear back from potential employers.
Just ban the box. Give us a chance to go in, have an interview, sell ourselves, let the person know who we are, because they're missing out on a lot of good workers.
We've got people on both sides of this question, employers, advocates. Binya Applebaum has reported in great detail on it. You can link to his story at our website, onpointradio.org. And a lot of callers. Elliot in Westwood, Massachusetts. You're on, Elliot. What's your story?
Yes, hi, Tom. I, like a couple of the other callers that you just played, you know, have a federal criminal conviction. I spent 6 months. It was a small crime, but yet it is a crime. And so, therefore, basically, as the other people said, and as Benjamin said in his article, we become unemployable. And I think that the discussion today is important, but I also think that it misses the point, because you can get past the ban the box, and you're still going to fail the background check. And so the ban the box can get you into the front door, and you can even have the interview. But once the criminal background check comes back, you will fail the background check. And as the previous interviewee said, is that basically companies just don't even want to take a chance. They don't want to deal with it. They see a conviction. They see a felony conviction. thank you very much, and, you know, you're on your way. And
Elliot, are they upfront about that in your experience? Have you gone through the process to that point? Do they then come into the room and say, Elliot, sorry, we see you, you know, your conviction, yes. You're out?
Yes, and also I proactively have told them, hey, I have a felony conviction.
Yeah.
I made a mistake, and they just don't want to deal with it. Basically, they're saying, you know, if it wasn't for this, we would have hired you. And it was large companies, small companies. Basically, unfortunately, when I was under supervision with a probation officer, his whole point was to get you employed. And as someone who was a white-collar worker who made a decent salary, you know, not a lot of money, not six figures, but, you know, he used to tell me, Home Depot. You know, if you can't find anywhere, go work at Home Depot.
Well, and I should say, Home Depot, along with Walmart, along with Target, they've stopped asking about it right at the beginning of the job application process. Did you try that, Home Depot?
I didn't because, you know, I kept hoping. And then finally I started, I became self-employed. I sell clothing on eBay.
Wow. You got to do what it takes. Elliot, I wish you good luck, but let me pick your point up with Binya Applebaum. Binya, what about this? Here's Elliot feeling sort of branded for life and saying banning the box isn't enough because there's still the background check that many people do, and then he gets shown the door.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that banning the box is not a complete solution. There's a balance to be struck here, obviously. We want employers to have relevant information, and in some cases, it's clear that certain people are probably not cut out for certain positions and that we would not want them in those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how do you create a process that, you know, gives people who have criminal records a better opportunity to be considered as individuals rather than to be systematically excluded? And it's important to note in this context that, you know, we've had a number of sort of impressive crimes attached to the people who have spoken on the show so far. The vast majority of these offenses are smaller things, often nonviolent drug offenses. You know, the question of whether someone who's, you know, twice been imprisoned for fighting with other people, whether you want them in your store is a different question than whether we should be systematically excluding, say, a man who was caught with a baggie of marijuana in his pocket, whether that offense should mean that you can't find work anymore. You know, that's a much harder thing to justify than to say that we want to have policies about people who've committed violent crimes.
Or you tell the story of Mike Mirsky, who just lost his job, was out of work, his life was falling apart. He gets arrested for resisting arrest, and boom, everything blows up on him.
It's a tragic comedy. I mean, he was arrested essentially because he had lost work.
Upset. I mean,
he couldn't pay his child support. The police come to your house. I don't want to speak to the particulars of what happened. I wasn't there. But resisting arrest, I think we all know, is a charge that can happen just because officer doesn't like the way you're looking at him. And for that to be the factor that ruins a man's life, I mean, wow, as a society, that's a tough place to be in, where a guy like Mike Mirsky, you know, who has this one brush with the law in his entire life, is now finding it difficult to find work, essentially because he lost work. That's a sticky wicket.
It's like something out of Les Mis. Binya Applebaum, stand by in Washington. I want to go to Chicago now, and Anthony Tony Lowry, he's Director of Policy and Advocacy for the SAFER Foundation. Tony Lowry, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tom, for having me.
And from Washington, Beth Melito joins us. She's Senior Counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business. Not so sure about banning the box. Beth, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Beth, let me come to you first, because we've heard a lot of the complaints here about this. You represent employers, so stand in their shoes for a minute. We've got a national problem here. How far should we go in prohibiting employers from inquiring in the application process about criminal records?
Well, I just want to start off by commenting, you know, you started your program off with a clip from Governor Christie, and then you had the clip from Mark, too, talking about giving felons a second chance.
Yeah.
But the overwhelming statistical fact is that many convicted felons use their second chance to commit more crimes. So is it fair, then, to forbid employers from asking what I would say is a very relevant question, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And I think the ban the box movement, like so many government interventions, sprouts from a very noble idea, but will actually cause more problems than it solves.
Well, I mean, I get you're worried that they'll come into the company and do something wrong again. But if they're frozen out and can't do legal work, how are they supposed to live in our society? Don't we create an underclass that's kind of branded for life?
Well, let me point out, too, that the laws, you know, prevent, you talked about all the exclusions from the laws, too. So the law prevents small business owners, and that's who I represent at the National Federation of Independent Business. So we're talking about small employers from asking the same question that we do want government agencies, financial institutions, schools, and even little leagues to ask on the employment application. You know, it's kind of ironic, I think, that, you know, on my way over to the studio today, I passed a daycare. Kids come first. And I think, you know, in a way, this is kind of a felons come first law. It's giving convicts more rights than the average citizen when it comes to the hiring process. Banning the box, prohibiting employers from having this, candid conversation with a candidate about not only their work history, but their criminal history during an interview is just, I think, absolutely absurd to say you can't talk about, you know, criminal history, convictions during an interview, you know, and you force employers to put that on the back end. I think you're actually going to encourage more employers to run a full, complete background check because they can't do it on the front end. They can't have that conversation, that face-to-face conversation during an interview.
Beth, stand by in Washington. Tony Lowry in Chicago. Is that what you're after? Don't even ask about it in the job interview.
No, Tom. What we're trying to do is get employers to be fair, to do the individual determinations, to look at people with criminal records as human beings, not as convicts, not as felons, as human beings who look at the education, the skills, the ability, do an individual determination as the EEOC guidelines suggest for employers. Safer Foundation, we see over 10,000 people a year. We have relationships with over 300 employers who know that we will provide them well-trained, drug-free clients. All people with criminal records are asking for is an opportunity to be seen as human beings, but I think best attitude about it is the attitude that we see from a lot of people that once you have committed a crime, no matter how minor it is, no matter how long ago, you're cast away, as Michelle Alexander said in The New Jim Crow. You're in second-class citizenship. Here in Chicago, we have an exponential explosion of violence in communities that are most impacted by criminal records because people see no opportunity, see no hope. The school kids see no one in their community that's going, working for legal gainful employment. The casualties from the war on drugs are not in Columbia, are not in Brazil. They're in Austin, North Lawndale, Inglewood communities of Chicago, and urban communities across the country. The war on drugs was the only war that was fought without a Marshall Plan to rebuild the communities in which the war was fought in. When you have 70 million people in this country with some type of indiscretion that will allow employers to discriminate against them, as Diva Pager from Princeton has shown, Dr. Harry Holzer from Georgetown has shown, the majority of employers will not, well, I don't want to say the majority, a large segment of employers have the same ideology that Beth has. Once a criminal, always a criminal. And they deny people the opportunity to have a real second chance to, first of all, rebuild themselves, rebuild their community.
But what do you say, Tony Lowry, to Beth Melito's concerns? You represent small businesses. You're going to hire somebody who's going to come in and commit a crime again, and then you've got a problem for them and a problem for the business. Are you sympathetic at all, or is she articulating the prejudice that you're worried about?
She's articulating the prejudice, but we work hand-in-hand with employers. We've got legislative relief before Ban the Box that was integrated to provide negligent liability protection for employers. Employers are our partners. We listen to their concerns. Again, we have over 300 employers that we work with on a regular basis. But what we want to do is educate the employer. Limit your exposure to liability by getting well-trained people who are ready to work. When you have blanket barriers to employment for a segment of the population, who does it benefit? We've been in this work a long time. Insurance companies are telling employers, don't hire, you'll be exposed to negligent liability concerns. And we've addressed that through legislation. But our legislative agenda for this year is trying to look at schools, parks, where a person in the state of Illinois who's convicted of having 10 grams of marijuana can never work in a park, can never work in a school. You're putting lifetime barriers. How do we put a lifetime barrier on a person for a nonviolent drug offense?
Tony Lowry, stand by right there. Illinois, of course, as of January this year, January 1st, banned the box laws there in Illinois and even tougher in Chicago. Beth Melito in Washington, we'll come back to you. And Binya Applebaum, lots of callers here. Amelia in Des Moines, Iowa. What do you think, Amelia? What's your experience?
Yes, Tom, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I this is one of my passions, one of my largest obstacles in my life. In 1981 and 1980, I was arrested for operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated. I was 17, 18 years old.
Okay.
I went on to obtain a two-year degree as a chemical dependency counselor and worked in the Department of Corrections with questions, but it was during the interview process about what your criminal history was. I worked in the Department of Corrections in a residential setting as a counselor for 13 years. I went on in that time and got my bachelor's degree in criminology and psychology.
So this sounds okay or not?
Well, that's okay, but I went on to get my master's degree. I left corrections to get a master's degree in vocational rehabilitation.
Yeah.
And I, everywhere I go now, and most applications are done online, have that box up front, and I don't even get an interview.
Amelia, if I may, how old are you now? Do the math for us.
I'm 53 years old. I've been sober since that time. I've not had anything to drink or drug.
Yeah.
Not even had a parking ticket.
Yeah.
And I had a woman, it was working in a juvenile correctional facility, say, oh, I didn't realize you had a criminal background. You have to go right now.
Amelia, stand by. Beth Melito, respond to this. I mean, here's Amelia. Her crime was DUI when she was 17, 18 years old. She's 53 now. Should she still be consigned to only working in the Department of Corrections? I mean, doesn't it seem like too much?
Well, and when I do education with my members, and that's a big part of my job, too, I talk about the need to do individualized assessments and consider things, you know, following the Equal Employment Opportunity guidance, you know, consider the seriousness of the offense, the time that's elapsed since the offense, and of course, the relevance and the nature of the job, too. I always say you should never outright, you know, ban any applicant that has, you know, a conviction, felony, misdemeanor, otherwise you should not be, you know, banning people that have arrest records. So I strongly encourage business owners to make that individualized assessment. But again, going back to the fact that small business owners have unique hiring practices. They are not Target, Walmart, Home Depot. They don't have human resource departments. The human resource person is often the business owner himself. He's the one that's going to have to go through the applications, set up the interviews, call the individual, bring the individual in for the interview. And to say that he can only ask about a conviction after the interview is just crazy when he's going to be sending that individual into your house.
Amelia in Iowa, I appreciate your call and I wish you good luck. Gordon in Felton, Delaware. Gordon, you're on.
Yes. Greetings, Tom. And I appreciate you addressing this this issue. Before I make two quick points regarding the issue, just a brief summary. I was arrested 9 times and had 24 criminal charges on my record. And I'm a bit of an anomaly in that it was one person who was responsible for the 9 arrests and 24 criminal charges. Not convicted. They were, each one would be subsequently dismissed over a period of 3 years. But yet an employer, and here's the salient point, and by the way, my criminal record, the state of Delaware messed up so badly that they actually paid to have every one of those charges expunged from my record. But it took years, the 3 years of hell that I went through. But during that time, and this is the one point that I want to make, is that the charge, the actual arrest, you don't even have to be convicted. An employer can look at that and say, 24 criminal charges, they were all dismissed. Where there's smoke, there's fire. So it's actually, it goes...
Well, it does sound bad, Gordon. I mean, what was going on? You got arrested 9 times and charged...
Well, it was a person who... And this is where, you know, it is so easy for the state, for the machine to get you into it. The person was eventually arrested for filing false police reports. But... The state didn't care until it was like that they had to address that issue, that it was false police reports. But all those charges were still on my record.
Yeah.
And so it made it extremely difficult without even having a conviction, just simply being arrested and having the charges.
Gordon, we'll come right back and look at that, just what an arrest itself might mean, let alone 9. Gordon, good luck to you. Thank you for calling. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about finding a job after a criminal conviction, maybe arrest. 70 million Americans face that challenge. There's a new push on to make it not so hard. 14 states now banning the box, the little box on often page one of a job application that asks if you've got an arrest or conviction in your background. And it happens that that's as far as it goes. Beth Melito is with us from the National Federation of Independent Business. She's worried about the burden that it puts on employers, small employers in particular, to make it not so easy just to push things aside. Anthony Lowry's with us from the Safer Foundation out of Chicago, representing people in this position and looking at how hard it can be. New Jim Crow, he says, a whole class of Americans kind of stuck. Binya Applebaum has been writing about all this very effectively for the New York Times and joins us from Washington. It's not just, even very prominent people wrestle with this. Here's actor Mark Wahlberg. He served 45 days in prison for assaulting two Vietnamese-American men when he was 16 years old. Here's an interview with NBC's Today Show in December. Wahlberg explaining why he's seeking a pardon to strike the conviction off his record.
People have said because of my celebrity, my success, that I'm basically waving that magic wand. But it's not about that. It's never been about that. I've been committed to turning my life around and becoming a productive person in the community.
Well, a lot of people might want to do that. It's not so easy. Binya Applebaum, what about an arrest itself? Can that be a stumbling block to a job?
So first, I want to correct a couple things that have been said.
Please.
The nature of these laws is really important to understand. There is no state and no jurisdiction that prohibits employers from investigating the background of a job applicant.
Mm-hmm.
All of these laws allow a criminal background check at some point during the hiring process.
It's just about when that happens, don't...
That's exactly right. It's about when that happens. And the most stringent of these laws in Hawaii has the additional provision that if an employer doesn't want to hire a person, they must establish that the conviction in question is related to the responsibilities that the individual would have in that job. But many states don't even require that. They're not prohibiting employers from making independent judgments about who they want to hire. They're simply asking them to wait until they've met the applicant before they do that. So that's a really important point to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And also, many of these laws have large exclusions for all sorts of categories of employment, like workers who enter homes or workers who deal with children or workers who are involved
daycare.
In mm-hmm. bank work or, you know, security work. So I think there's been a little bit of a mischaracterization of what these laws actually do. Now, regarding arrest records, it is absolutely true that just having an arrest record can be treated by employers as if you had a misdemeanor or a felony conviction. And in fact, one of the really striking things here is how bad these online databases are. So there's this illusion that we now have excellent information about people's past, but those records are riddled with errors. It is very easy to have your identity conflated with the identity of a person who has a similar name. Even more problematic, these records often indicate that there was an arrest, but not what happened in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was this, I write about this study where, you know, the federal government required 1.2 million port workers to submit to background checks, and it identified 59,000 of them as having felony convictions that excluded them from employment at the port. Well, 30,000 of those employees, 30,000 of those 59,000
yeah.
said to the government, you made a mistake, your background checks are incorrect. And in 25,000 of those cases, the government ultimately concluded that its background check had been wrong.
That's crazy.
That's an astonishing statistic. That means the government was wrong 42% of the time when it identified someone as having a felony record. If you think that employers are accurately identifying people when they do these background checks, it's really worth considering that statistic. This is a very imperfect technology, and if it's being relied upon, the results are putting a lot of people into a category they don't belong in.
We've got State Representative Fred Dural calling from Detroit, Michigan. Representative Dural, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. How are you today?
I'm okay. What do you think about this ban the box move?
Well, I think it's a really good move. I presented legislation here in Michigan, House Bill 4208, to ban the box, and more properly known here as the Employment Fairness Act. We believe that it will give returning citizens a second chance to at least get in the door, get an interview, and not necessarily be disqualified off top.
Do you have employers pushing back, Representative, saying this is too much trouble, we can't take the chance?
Well, we've received actually a pretty good response from employers and felon-friendly hiring employers who are willing to come to the table. We've been coming to committee to testify and be kind of stakeholders in this process. And they believe that, you know, some of our returning citizens, they're returning from prison. They have a lot of skills that could be very, very helpful and very, very useful to their businesses.
What do the prospects look like in the Michigan legislature?
Well, right now it's currently going to be in our Commerce and Trade Committee. We're looking to get a hearing on the bill. This is a reintroduced bill from last session. And so we're reintroducing it this year. And it got a lot of, acclaim last year and a lot of media attention last year and a lot of responses from the community. We've had many stakeholders, many returning citizens come testify even last year in committee in regards to this bill. We've even had the employers come. And so I think it'll receive a really good response. We're going to push really hard for it. I think it's very important here in Michigan. It's very important for our economy, as I've heard some of the other people who have been on the radio today talk about helping push our economy in Michigan as well and get people back to work.
Yeah, Representative Fred Durrell, we're up against the clock here, but I really appreciate you checking in, and I wish you good luck with that. Thank you for your report, your call right there. If I may get one more, Joe in Wilmington, North Carolina. Joe, you're on.
Yes. I went to truck driving school. I'm a truck driver.
Yeah.
And when I come out of school, I went to work for a company. I didn't put the misdemeanor. It was a misdemeanor for simple possession of marijuana on
okay.
the dollar fine.
Yeah.
And I didn't put it on the application, and they found out about it like a month later, and they fired me for falsifying the application.
Okay.
And then I went. It was tough for me to give a job, but somebody gave me a chance. You know, and I wound up staying with them for like 8 years. I wanted to switch jobs, and I called a company in Arkansas and told them I was never going to get fired for falsifying the application again. So I was up front. I told them I had a misdemeanor
right.
for possession of marijuana, $100 fine. They said we could never hire you. And this was back in the 80s. And I said, well, wait a minute. Bill Clinton admitted inhaling, and he was the president. He could blow up the world if he, you know, happened to. And I just want to drive a truck. You could teach a monkey to drive a truck. And they said they could never hire me for a $100 fine. I mean, now there's states where smoking dope is legal. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, and still it's a hurdle in your life. Joe, I'm glad you called. I'm very glad you've called. Beth Melito, look at that story. You got to be sympathetic with Joe. $100 misdemeanor fine all those years back for possession of pot. And he says, you know, come on, look, Bill Clinton gets to be president. I can't drive a truck.
And that's where I go back to the need to make an individualized assessment. But an employer
can't
make the assessment.
But they didn't. He called them. He told them. And they said, forget it. We won't even.
And it sounds like a situation where there may have been, as Binya talked about, those mm-hmm. federal or state laws, the transportation laws that may have come into play there that tied the employer's hand in that, you know, that situation. There are a lot of other federal and state laws that come into play here that the employers don't have any control over. But I'll just go back and say that ban the box policy is not good for all employers or all industries. And I think that last story, you know, shows that. That there isn't a one-size-fits-all, but, you know, you need to give the employer the information. They can't make an individualized assessment if they don't have the information to assess.
Tony,
you need to have that face-to-face.
Yeah, but, Tony, what about it? You get people out on the highway with a big rig. Of course, those employers are going to be very sensitive about drug usage. It's not as if there's not drug usage in that industry, but still, you can see why they'd be nervous about it, Tony.
Yeah, and we can always see the concern, but, again, we want people, again, as Beth just echoed, the individual determination. Our history has shown us that rehabilitation is not a made-up word, that people do need the opportunity to, when they change their lives, a basic opportunity to work. Employers are looking for incentives. They're looking for tax breaks. But what is the employer's responsibility for rebuilding America, for providing people an opportunity? We're talking about just working. We're not talking about affirmative action. We're not talking about set-asides. We're talking about an opportunity to come in and be an asset to your company. Again, I've seen thousands of challenges. In my individual life, there's been a challenge with over a 20-year-old drug conviction. Today, I'm director of policy at Safer Foundation. I've testified in the United States Congress, Illinois General Assembly, done numerous, won many awards throughout the country.
So give a man the chance.
For programs in public housing. We're supposed to be a nation of second chances. Can we give people who have shown they've turned their lives around an opportunity for employment? I think that's the teaching opportunity that we have with advocates for employers to get them to understand what an individual determination means.
Let me, if I may, get James in Austin, Texas. James, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just make the point as a small business owner, I think part of the equation here is that you have to look at the other applicants for the job. So if I'm looking at 10 applicants for a job and 9 of them have not made a decision that has resulted in incarceration or arrest and one has, why can't I as a business owner make that decision? Why in reality are we not discriminating against the other 9 that have chosen not to make a bad move or a bad choice?
Well, but here, James, I mean, what Ben Yappelbaum and others are saying, in the end, you can make that decision, but they're saying don't just make it right off the bat on the basis of a checkbox so that the guy with some or gal with something in their background, the criminal, you know, can't even talk to you about it. I mean, are you willing to even give them the chance of getting that far as an employer, small business owner?
So if I have 9 prospective employees and I look at the track record of the decisions that they've made over the past 5 to 10 years and I see good decisions and I have limited resources as an employer and I can't possibly interview everybody, then I do have to some extent to look at a snapshot of the decisions they've made over the past 10 years and use that to move forward.
James, I appreciate your call because it helps people understand how a small employer might look at this. If I may, let me get a rejoinder to that right from your town, from Austin, Texas. Another caller there, Aaron. Aaron, you just heard James in your town, Austin. What do you say?
Well, first, you're right. James does not ever find out who, you know, you can still do a background check on people. The whole point of Ban the Box is to just take that stumbling block away from people. I work for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. I run a reentry program, and the biggest barrier for people being successful in their lives is obtaining employment when they get out of prison. 97% of people who are in prison are getting out, and we have to be able to accommodate that, because if you don't have a job and you need to be able to eat, you're going to steal things.
We get it. We've paid attention to the job seekers' side of this, and who wouldn't be sympathetic to that? Think about James' situation for a second, Aaron. How do you look at that? He's saying he's a small business owner. He gets 10 applicants for the job. You can't interview everybody.
I totally understand that. What this does is it just removes that initial barrier of I'm just going to throw this application away. If somebody's got all of the qualifications, but, for example, you had that guy who called earlier who said he had a drug charge in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
For 25 years, he's been clean.
Yep.
I mean, should that really be held against him today? So talking to people, getting your foot in the door is half the battle for folks who have backgrounds. I'm not saying that you shouldn't ever look at that background and decide that that is something that is not something that you need. However, getting the foot in the door, you may meet somebody who's amazing, who has a background that you decide that you want to give that chance to.
I appreciate your call from Austin as well. Binya Applebaum, I wonder how you're looking at this. I mean, we've got other callers here on both sides of this, but here's another employer from Pensacola, Florida, saying, you know, I need the cream of the crop. I don't have time. How do you think about the employer's side of this? Do they have
I think that obviously they're raising a very legitimate concern, but there's something I want to hone in on particularly, because we've made it almost through this full hour without noting the incredible role that race plays in all of this. This problem is disproportionately a problem in the black community, and it brings me to something that employer in Austin just said, which I think is not true, which is that he's making a choice among people, and one of them has made a different decision than the others, and they need to live with the consequences of that. The reality is that that's not the way criminal justice works in this country. People make the same choices, and some of them end up with criminal records, and some of them do not.
What do you mean? Clarify what you mean there.
It is much easier to get arrested for possession of marijuana if you are a young black man in an urban neighborhood than it is if you are a young white man in a suburban neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so people who have criminal records for marijuana possession may not have made different choices than the applicants who do not. Race plays an incredibly important role in this story, to the point where the federal government has said that using background checks as a way to systematically screen applicants is inherently a form of discrimination because it has such a disproportionate effect on black applicants. The nature of what we have done in the war on crime in this country has fallen with disproportionate weight on African American communities. And as a consequence, the way that we treat people with criminal records is very much a story. It's primarily a story about the way we are treating people in those African American communities. And I completely understand why employers would look at a criminal record and say, this is a strike against that applicant. It obviously is. It represents a bad life choice that they made. But to view it as being in the way that employer just described it, a sign that that person has done something no one else in their applicant pool has done, I think in some cases that's just not true.
Tony Lowry, I've just got half a minute here. If we don't figure out how to fix this with 70 million, maybe plus people in this category, what's it mean for our country, for our society?
Well, Tom, America would not reach its fullest potential. It would not work at optimum level. I have people with master's degrees, 20-year-old conviction, can't get a job. Something is fundamentally wrong with a country that does not look at the individual circumstances and just have that blanket barrier that discriminates against people for the rest of their lives. Criminal records punishment is permanent. The majority of people who have criminal records have never spent a day in prison. Probation is a conviction. So I think there needs to be more education, but more of a commitment from employers to provide a second chance to people who have shown rehabilitation and have made the hard grind and the footwork to turn their lives around.
Anthony Lowry with Safer Foundation in Chicago. I've never seen as much focus on this as there is right now. Maybe there's a change afoot. Tony Lowry, thank you very much for joining us. And Beth Melito with the National Federation of Independent Business. Beth, thank you for your perspective today.
Thank you very much.
Benjamin Applebaum with the New York Times, thanks for all your reporting and for being with us.
Glad to join you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. ¶¶